Bienvenidos and welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show. I'm your host, as always, Matthew Miranda, joining you on a beautiful day in late May. Beautiful for many reasons. The weather is delightful. It is my last day to finish grading for the semester, so very excited about that. Obviously a great time in the world of sports. We have the NBA down to seemingly its final two teams. Denver is up 3-0 on the Lakers, and last night Miami took a 3-0 lead on the Boston Celtics. So barring one or two unprecedented events, the NBA will not have a Lakers-Celtics finals, but instead will have Denver and Miami, which I'm sure they are just tickled pink about as far as ratings go. WNBA season has also just kicked off. Very exciting night yesterday in Brooklyn when the New York Liberty, the new super team in progress, made their home debut, and Breonna Stewart, who signed this season from the Seattle Storm, had a historic performance, 45 points, 12 rebounds, and 6 3-pointers, only the second WNBA player ever to put up that combined line, joining the great Maya Moore. Very exciting time at the Barclays Center, very exciting season for the Liberty. So good time in sports, and of course I would be remiss if I did not point out the biggest story of the weekend, which was, of course, Nottingham Forest staying alive in the Premier League. No, of course, it's Manchester City winning the Premier League for the third year in a row, the fifth year out of six, and if you really want to take it back, the seventh year out of the last 12 that the Sky Blues have been champions of England. Treble is definitely still on the table. City have won the first leg of it. They have an FA Cup final. You know, the treble is in English soccer, I guess in any league, if you can win the trophy for winning your league, if you can win the League Cup trophy, every league in Europe, they play a separate competition between teams from all levels, not just their top league. So it would be like if baseball had a tournament that included the major leagues and AAA and AA, and like just included everybody. That's what the FA Cup is like in England. City will play the final against Man United on June 3rd, which is a chance to put their noisy neighbors back where they belong. And then they play, of course, the Champions League final on June 10th, which will be against Inter Milan. That is pretty much, that's what's left. If they can pull those two out, and they're favored in both games, for what it's worth, they would become only the second English side ever to win the treble, joining Man United. So United has a little extra motivation to try to stop City. To this point, City look fairly unstoppable. At the start of April, they were 8 points out of first in the league, and they end up clinching it with 3 games left to go. That's pretty remarkable. So those are your kind of broad headlines, what's going on in sports. I'm just waiting a couple of minutes for today's guest to arrive. Very excited to have them here and to get to talk about what we're going to speak about with them. In the meantime, if you have anyone that you would like to hear, I don't want to shock you, but being the podcast host of a socialist pod is not always everyone else's cup of tea as far as where they are dreaming to end up. So sometimes I reach out to people, I don't hear from people. Are there people you would like to hear on the pod? Hit us up. Gmail, jacobinsports@gmail.com. You can message us on Twitter @TheJacobinSportsShow. But let me know who's out there that maybe I'm not knowing about or I'm not thinking about that you would like to see included. I will do my best to make that happen. But now, very exciting moment in the history of the JSS. I would like to introduce today's guest to everybody. Today's guest, a freelance writer. They cover sports, gender, culture, and queerness. Their work has appeared in the New York Times, Sports Illustrated, Vogue, The Washington Post, Bleacher Report, The Ringer, and The Atlantic, among other places. And, along with friend of the pod, Lindsay D'Arcangelo, co-authored the book Hail Mary, The Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League. Very excited to have on the pod today for the first time, Frankie de la Creta. Frankie, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, very excited. I've been a fan of yours for quite some time. Discovered you on Twitter, and as a sports writer, as a human who shares stories from their life, I just really admire you so much as a person. You mean a lot to me, not just for your approach to sports, but just your approach to life. And I don't get to say that to many of our guests, so just want to thank you for that right from the start.
Oh, thank you so much. That's really kind.
Yeah. First question I have for you is not a question that I was preparing to ask you, but I want to know if the number 316 means anything special to you, and if it has always been something special to you.
Does it?
Foxborough Stadium.
Oh, I got it. Yes.
That just a happy? I didn't know if the number had some other significance, or if you just happened to be in section.
No, that was my section at the Taylor Swift concert in Gillette Stadium this weekend, where I proposed to my partner, and the whole section helped out. We had people behind us filming. Confetti was thrown. People cheered. It was really lovely.
It's a beautiful video. It was very cool to see. So congratulations to you both.
Thank you.
So now on to the journalistic stuff. I want to talk about a couple questions in a few of your pieces, but I want to start with a piece you wrote about a week and a half ago about swimming and what a transphobic space it is. And we had on the pod a while ago, Joanna Mellis, the great swimmer and sports scholar. And she gave a real edifying kind of elaboration at the end of the episode about the history of swimming and racism, and specifically anti-blackness in this country. A lot of things I had not known at all. And you mentioned in your piece that there are reasons why swimming, women's swimming in particular, I think is such a fertile ground for transphobia in sports. Can you talk at all about some of the conditions or some of the realities historically or just in the sport that have helped make it such a hotspot for this kind of hatred?
Yeah, absolutely. And Johanna was a really important source for my story as well. She really knows what she's talking about, and I appreciate her work a lot too. You know, my hope with this piece, I will say, is that I think a lot of people know as a whole that, you know, sports have taken this like kind of a hard right turn around trans inclusion generally. And we're seeing this in sports across the board. And my hope was that I could use swimming as a case study almost to show how, you know, even though the overarching theme of transphobia and trans exclusion touches all sports, it looks a little bit different sport by sport, depending on the cultures that exist there. And swimming in particular, not only did they have all of the cultural elements present for this very extreme transphobic backlash, they also had a trans woman swimmer named Leah Thomas competing in NCAA, you know, collegiate swimming, who performed really well. And so when she came in and came up in this sport, it kind of activated this base that already existed there. And swimming in particular, as you mentioned, has a history of anti-blackness. It's an overwhelmingly white sport. And that's important because, you know, transphobia is linked to ideas of white supremacy. Any gender variance that deviates from, you know, white Western ideals of femininity is seen as, you know, threatening. And so that impacts, you know, women of color, but also trans women. And so these ideas cannot be separated out from each other. They're integral. And swimming, you know, for a very long time, pools were sites of not only segregation, but, you know, racial violence. And so this is all just inherent, right? Swimming was one of the first sports that white women were allowed to compete in. It was seen as an acceptable sport for women because of the fact that it was seen as feminine and clean, and all of these things. And so that is like that is the history that the sport is built on, right? And then you come into that and you have these two other elements that happened to women swimmers of a particular era who now have a lot of influence on the sport. One of those things is a doping scandal from East German swimmers in it was most talked about at the 1976 Olympics, where the women, the East German swimmers won like all but one medal in that, in those Olympic Games. And they were, it was state sanctioned doping. They were being given synthetic testosterone without their consent. And you know, that experience has really stuck with, understandably so, a lot of women swimmers of that generation. They describe the East German swimmers as very mannish, as having, you know, deep voices and mustaches, things like that. And so there is this misconstruing of what happened in that case, which is, right, increasing testosterone levels for an athletic advantage, and also a violation of these women's bodily autonomy and issues of consent. Like, these women were victimized by state-sanctioned abuse, right? And we are equating that with these perceived and higher testosterone levels in trans women, which is not only scientifically inaccurate, it's just, you know, I think it equates things that aren't equal, but it's also like an opportunistic way to use, right, this incident. The third piece that I bring in to this entire discussion is something that is not unique to swimming, but has been very prominent in swimming, which is sexual abuse history among, you know, a lot of women and girls have suffered sexual abuse at the hands of male coaches in swimming. And there was a real, you know, scandal in women's swimming. And, you know, Safe Sport, which is supposed to handle investigations into this kind of abuse, was started because of, you know, USA Swimming's kind of reckoning and PR crisis around the issues in the sport. And what has happened there is it has made a lot of the, I'd say, women who experienced that, it's made them especially susceptible to transphobic talking points around the fact that, so one of the most common transphobic talking points, right, is that trans women are biological males, right? And therefore they are a threat. And they are a threat not only in the, you know, on the field or in the pool, but also in the locker room. And it basically capitalizes on the trauma that cis women have experienced at the expense of trans women. Of course, erasing the fact that trans women are actually more likely to be victims of abuse and assault, and they experience the same kind of violence at the hands of cis men that cis women do. But it like pits these two marginalized groups against each other. And that's a lot of stuff I just threw at you, but it's kind of these three cultural forces that I said, you know, the anti-blackness and the GDR doping scandal and the history of sexual abuse in the sport that kind of come to together to create this like perfect storm for a transphobic backlash to take place.
I'm so glad that you elaborated on all of that, because it's a lot to take in, but it's not a lot of time to give someone like a better understanding of the actual, all of the foundational forces that are there in the beginning that really underlie a lot of what is going on. I want to come back to something you said about marginalized communities, but I also wanted to ask, what is it, why is Leah Thomas taken as a threat in a way that I don't know if I pronounce her name correctly, but Natalie Fahey and Katy Ledecky are not.
So Katy Ledecky is a cis woman, and she, you know, holds all kinds of records that Leah Thomas has not even come close to touching, right? Leah Thomas broke some records, but did not even come close to touching Katy Ledecky's records. She's very muscular in a way that Leah Thomas also is, and Leah Thomas was criticized for. Katie Ledecky did not experience the same kind of, you know, body policing and pushback because she's a cis woman. Meanwhile, Natalie Fahey's the first trans woman to, you know, compete in collegiate swimming. And she competed in the men's division. Even after she came out as trans and started her transition, she competed in one women's meet, but it was like an exhibition kind of swim and not competitive. So she was not competing against women. Mm-hmm. Leah Thomas not only has, you know, competed in the women's division, but she's starting to and did have success. And so I think that's the important thing. We see trans women becoming threats to the status quo and be targeted by these exclusionary policies once they start to have success. And I will say trans women have been competing in sports kind of forever. They've been allowed to compete at the Olympics since 2003, and we didn't have the first one there until, you know, these past Olympic Games. A lot of people don't know that. And I think...
I had no idea. That's very interesting.
Yeah. And I think there's someone, I wish I remembered his name, but he's working on a book about, like, trans Olympians that goes back to, like, you know, the 20s. And this, to me, compares to the reason that I think that sports are sex segregated in the first place. Sports were not always sex segregated, and there's this history of men and women competing together, and once a woman wins, like, the next year there will be a women's category because it is threatening, right? When a woman beats a man, we saw this happen in figure skating in like 1906. We saw this happen with trap shooting in the Olympics in like the year 1992. That sport was always competed as co-ed until a woman won the gold medal for the first time. And after that, women were not allowed. And we're talking about trap shooting. This is a sport that doesn't, you know, wouldn't seem to have a you know, gendered component to it. Mm-hmm. And so this is what happens, right? Is a woman winning against a man is a threat to the status quo. It's a threat to, like, ideas about masculinity. And so women have to get their own division. And I kind of see the same idea happening when trans women have success, which now they become a threat to the status quo, and we have to remove them.
Yeah. You made a point. You know, there's that very persistent, pernicious tactic that the powers that be will, it's endemic at this point, where marginalized groups will be pitted against each other, will pit themselves against one another instead of seeing, like, where the actual danger is coming from. You mentioned in the piece a former swimmer, I guess an Olympian, Nancy Hogshead McCarr, I think is her name.
Yep.
And she, who was an advocate for girls in swimming, and who essentially appears to be a TERF, far as I can see.
That's a fair label.
You talk very movingly, I think, in the piece about there's a shortcoming when you, not just a shortcoming, doesn't even say it, I think, fully. The damage when you try to protect the failure, when you claim to be advocating for a group or seeking to protect for a group while you ignore the most vulnerable part of that group. Can you talk a little, I mean, you made reference to this in the piece, but, and I think it's, I know for myself, it's something different. It hits on a different element when you have a general sense of the biases and the injustices that a group suffers, but to read specifically about that group being even, and I have a relation to it as I'm Puerto Rican. I have, you know, I'm queer in various ways. And it's not a community that is always inherently embracing of that. And there could be danger to that in the outside world, but coming back to your culture where you want to feel like, well, at least now I know these people get it, that's not always the reality. You're talking about a group of women who are the most vulnerable. It's on your TV every single day, it's on your Twitter feed all day. Like, there is a group of people right now that is the most vulnerable group in the country, and to know that even from your own, even from, it's not long after the same battles that that some of these TERFs are now fighting against them? I don't have a question. I just spit a lot at you, but my God.
Yeah, I think that. Well, so I'll talk about Nancy Hogsenmacher for a minute, because she has a very large and outsized, I will say, influence on trans exclusionary policies and the conversation around trans women, specifically competing in women's sports, for a couple of reasons. One, she was an Olympian. She was an Olympic swimmer. In an individual sport, we tend to put those people on pedestals and give them platforms. And the other piece is that she's a Title IX lawyer. I disagree with the way she interprets Title IX, but whatever, she's a Title IX lawyer. Mm-hmm. And before she dedicated her life to excluding trans women from women's sports, she actually dedicated her life to rooting out sexual abuse in sports and, you know, women's swimming particularly. She founded an organization called Champion Women. She has been open about her own sexual abuse history in the sport of swimming and really did a lot of important work. I had interviewed her before. I really like looked up to what she was doing. And so it's incredibly disappointing to see people who have been lifelong advocates for women, for women's bodily autonomy, for women's sports, making trans women the enemy in this conversation. And to me, what happens is they frame it as protecting girls and women's sports from trans women. What that does is imply that trans women are not women. But it also implies that they are a danger or a threat to cis women. And to me, that puts the conversation in the wrong place. When we talk about inclusion and fairness, we should be making sure that we center the inclusion of and fairness for the most marginalized of the people in the group that we are talking about. And so, you know, it frames this conversation around what cis women perceive as fair or how they feel about competing against trans women, rather than framing the conversation around how trans women feel about being excluded and harassed, you know, from the sports that they really care about. And like you brought up, and I mentioned before, something that the TERF community, the trans exclusionary movement, has done really, really well is pit cis women and trans women against each other by implying that trans women are some kind of a threat based on the sex that they were assigned at birth. It capitalizes on cis women's trauma. It capitalizes on cis women's fear and oppression and, you know, the real harms they have suffered under patriarchy. But what it does is it ignores the fact that patriarchy also harms trans women, and that actually cis women and trans women should be allies in this fight against, you know, cis male violence, against patriarchy, against this kind of oppression. And to me, we're not going to see any movement towards a truly trans inclusive sporting environment until cis women realize that these same policies that are being used to police the bodies of trans women to exclude them are also threats to them and their bodily autonomy. It is not until cis women see their struggle is inherently linked with that of trans women that we're really going to see the needle move here, I think.
There's a quote right at the end of your piece, this particular one, that I wanted to ask you if you thought there was hope in these words. I don't know if they were meant this way, but it's a piece, it's a quote from Shyler Bailar. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Shyler says, you have this quote at the end. It's quote, "Swimming isn't inherently transphobic. It just was the first sport in which a trans woman excelled in the way that Leah did, and so publicly in the way that Leah did. And I think that galvanized the pre-existing building anti-trans sentiments that were already there. I think that could have happened in any sport." That's a horrible thing, obviously, on one level to say, but do you think there's any optimism that what you're talking about?
I don't feel very optimistic about the state of sports when it comes to trans inclusion and, you know, inclusion for trans women in particular. We are seeing sporting bodies across the board pass increasingly restrictive policies that pretty much ban trans women from being able to compete. I think what's the most frustrating about that is that it goes against so much guiding kind of work. And I say that because, so first of all, just flat out, the United Nations Human Rights Watch have deemed this kind of sex testing, have deemed these kind of policies that police bodies in the way that these trans exclusionary policies do, they've been deemed to be human rights violations. So flat out, they should not be happening.
Isn't McCarr's group like considered like a hate group by them? Because of...
Yes. So the group that Nancy Hogshead-Macker is founded, it's called the Women's Sports Policy Working Group. She also founded that with another former Olympic swimmer named Donna DiVerona and Martina Navratilova. So these well-known, you know, athletes, it's been called a hate group by the Human Rights Campaign. Because of the policies that they're pushing for, which, okay, so again, right, deemed human rights abuses. The International Olympic Committee, which should be kind of the guiding kind of light of elite international sports, they came out with a new framework. I guess it's probably about, don't quote me on when it was, but recent, at least like a year ago. And it actually said that sporting bodies should stay away from policies that are based on policing testosterone levels and towards models that are inclusive. However, what the International Olympic Committee did not do is put any enforcement mechanism. It's not a policy, it's a framework. It's like a series of suggestions. And so they left it up to each individual sporting body. So this has no teeth. So if a sporting body wants to be exclusionary, they can, and the IOC is not going to do shit about it, which, you know, I think is terrible, but it is a big deal that they said there's no scientific basis for these kind of testosterone-based policies, and it's harming people. The International Olympic Committee says sports are a human right. So as we exclude people based on their gender or their sex, we are violating their human rights. And then you have on top of that, there have been a couple cases that have been brought in U.S. court. Particularly the one I will cite is J.C. Cooper brought her case with Women's USA Powerlifting to Minnesota's Human Rights Court, and she won. She won a discrimination case. And so when we are challenged, when we are actually looking at the facts of what is trans exclusion actually doing, is that, you know, it's been deemed not legal. It's been deemed a human rights violation. It's been deemed to have like no scientific basis in reality. And yet sporting bodies are continuing to just ignore all of that and put these incredibly harmful policies in place. It feels really bleak as somebody who covers this. It does. I don't see a lot of hope, at least in the very near future.
Do you feel bleaker now than you did 2 years ago, 5 years ago?
Yeah, because I think what's happening is it's not just the political climate of sports that's changing. It's the political climate at large that is becoming so fascist, I guess we'll go
with. That's a good word for it.
You know, and what I will say is women's sports and sports in general seems to be the one place politically that it seems to be widely accepted to ban trans people from. There seems to be arguments that, you know, right around fairness and stuff like this, that people will buy into. It's like seen as the acceptable place to discriminate, where a lot more people are horrified by things like the bathroom bills, by things like the fact that, like, if I use the, you know, restroom in Florida right now, I could be arrested, you know, things like that. People are a lot more, I think, general. People are a lot more like, ooh, that seems bad. But then you're like, but sports. And they're like, oh, but that makes sense though, right? Because fairness.
Think about the children.
Yeah. So I think like there's this piece too that sports actually seems to be one place where even people who would define themselves as liberal could be swayed or see it as an acceptable place to like discriminate against trans people.
So let me bring capitalism into the mix because we haven't discussed enough significant concepts yet. I had Katie Heindel on the show a couple weeks ago, the great basketball writer, and we were talking about how this year at the NCAA women's basketball Final Four, ticket prices were going for insane prices. And there were reasons that complicated it. The men's game was held in a much larger venue, so you know there was less supply, high demand. But I was interested in how it was generally framed as like, this is a positive, this is more indication of the growth and the success of women's sports, and this is a good thing. And you know, I covered the WNBA, and I was thinking about the WNBA this season as a league where there are all these capitalist metrics by which the league is doing well. And if the league is doing well and growing, we can pat ourselves like, that's a good thing. It's a good thing that it's developing. But when you're following, you know, capitalist metrics of anything, like, you know where it's leading eventually. Like it's not the yellow brick road. Like, so I'm wondering about with the WNBA specifically, as that league, and it's a league that is considered by liberals certainly, and by a lot of people who call themselves progressive. Like, it has to be probably the most socially progressive major league that I can think of, certainly more than any of the men's sports in terms of prominent leagues. Maybe there's one I don't know of, but they seem to be ahead of the curve among leftists on a lot of things. But as they succeed, you know, they're going to grow. And as they grow, they're going to become more what capitalism is going to turn them into. So I had a question in here. I think it was about, you know, is there a point where, oh, I wanted to realize, I'm sorry. I got the cart ahead of the horse. I was going to ask you about this in relation to your football piece. That's why, sorry. There's so much to talk to you about that, like, my brain is jumping from one of your pieces to another. If I can make a segue to your football piece.
Sure.
You wrote a piece for In These Times. I have the title right here. Sorry, everybody, give me 1 second. It is a really, really great piece. The Complicated Case for Gender Equality in Football. And so here's what I was trying to get to before. Sorry about this. So in the piece, you talk about how the NFL is making an investment in women's flag football. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, this is a great thing. And in part, it's a great thing because football specifically teaches these important lessons and principles that you can only apparently learn by playing tackle football. And it's growing. And you make mention of the piece of how there are schools giving scholarships for this, like flag football, women's flag football. And I think men's flag football also, as more people are pulling away from tackle football as children in general, because of the CTE stuff. There's a growth of flag football in general, but there's definitely investment on some level on women's flag football, which you contrast to women's tackle football, which also exists, which the NFL is extremely aware of. You made a point. Robert Kraft, I think, lent the Boston team the use of his the Patriots team flight. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's not the same, hey, like, we should also promote women's tackle football. Like, there's definitely not the same support for that there. If women's tackle football isn't going to be supported the way that women's flag football is, is there any point in supporting, just conceptually, supporting women's flag football? Since from the start, it seems to be an enterprise that is in part being exclusionary towards not only types of women, but ideas of things that women can do and should do.
Well, sure. I'd say that I think flag football and, you know, tackle football are two slightly different sports, right? And so flag football is a legitimate sport in its own right. I think the question I wanted to ask with that piece, though, right, is the fact that the NFL is investing in women's flag football, but not in women's tackle football. Is that, you know, a good thing because of the CTE crisis and we want to be pushing people away from tackle football? You know, kind of the is equal opportunity brain damage really a feminist win kind of question, you know, or is it the fact that there are these paternalistic ideas at play around what sports women should or should not be playing? And so the fact that the NFL is supporting flag football rather than tackle is actually based in these, not in, you know, a real legitimate health concern, but in these paternalistic ideas about women needing to be protected or, you know, keeping women out of these traditionally masculine roles and spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, specifically, you touched on this in the piece, this idea of controlling who can take risks with their body. It's body control again. Like, that's not, we know this isn't good for you. Like, so we'll steer you away from it. I'm curious in the piece, because you talk about how, and you have a couple of your subjects, your interview subjects, Nathan Coleman-Lamb, who we've had on the pod also, and someone else talk about basically they're not fans of equal opportunity dementia, I think is how one person put it. If the NFL, I know this would never happen, but if the NFL were to change its rules to be more towards flag football, like to eliminate a lot of the obvious violence that goes into what makes it such a dangerous sport, would that legitimize women's flag football in any way? Because now the industry as a whole is saying we want to get away from violence, like we want everyone to be risk averse, or is that like just a thought exercise that doesn't really get?
Well, it's funny, you know, you
the justice reality.
In my piece, I have people who do disagree, right? We have some people who are like, I believe this sport for men, women, for everyone should be like abolished, right? I think because of how violent and dangerous it is. Then I talked to someone, Dr. Christopher Matthews, who actually I found incredibly. He challenged me actually on that idea as a whole. And he talked about, you know, because, okay, so a lot of women who play tackle football, when you talk to them about the fact that they play this game that could be incredibly dangerous, they'll say, I'm taking an informed risk with my body, right? Just like the men who play are. And I don't need to be protected. I can make a choice. I'm choosing to engage in, you know, this dangerous activity. Mm-hmm. And what Dr. Matthew said that I really, really found fascinating was he said two things. One, he was like, I don't think we should outlaw anything that is like could kill you, right? He's like, I drink, I smoke, like I want to keep doing those things even though they could kill me, right? He's like, where the problem comes in, though, is when we start to talk about this, like taking an informed risk. He was like, he's like, that's where I think the ball is being dropped, is that nobody actually, men or women, is being informed appropriately as to what the risk is. They know kind of vaguely that they could have dementia as a result of playing this sport. But are we actually informing people what it is like to live with dementia and showing them what the day-to-day like life is going to look like and could look like? Have to, you know, and there's very few people that actually know that. People who have taken care of a relative, right, maybe, who has dementia or something like that and have really seen it like firsthand. But he's like, that level of education is actually what would be needed to provide the level of informed consent necessary to allow somebody to make the choice to then go and decide that they want, you know, to participate in this kind of sport. And I thought that that was an interesting argument, and I agreed with it. You know, and he was like, I do a lot of things that could kill me and I don't want people to tell me I can't. And I was like, that's a fair point, right? But like, what, and so what he's asking is like, what does informed consent actually look like? What does an informed risk actually look like? And that is where we are failing athletes, like across the board, gender wise.
Yeah, I think relating to that, you there's a your piece. It's interesting that there's no for all the reasons that the NFL is in support of encouraging flag football for women, you don't see any correspondent energy to promoting it for men. You know, like
right.
It's interesting how that works.
Right. And I think there's, you know, a lot of the thing is the women's tackle game as a like whole isn't a, it doesn't have the same kind of, I'll use to go with capitalistic language, it doesn't have the same product, right? Women's tackle football is spread across several leagues. It's decentralized. It divides up the talent. It divides up the money. It's still very grassroots. You still have the team that you mentioned, the Boston Renegades, who, you know, the Patriots lent their plane to. They're the world champions in women's football, in the Women's Football Alliance. They are beating teams by 60 points a game. So you have this like real skill differential, and that kind of product is not appealing as an investment opportunity. It's not appealing to a fan base, you know, and so this is where there's also probably, you know, reasons, capitalistic reasons why the NFL would not be investing in women's football in the way that they're investing in women's tackle football in the way that they're investing in women's flag football.
Do you know if women's tackle football has been at least growing over the last, even decentralized as it is, like, is it growing? Is it kind of a back and forth thing?
It's so hard to say. What I will say is, so women's tackle football, you know, I wrote a book about the first women's professional tackle football league in the US. That was in the 70s and 80s. After that league folded in 1988, there was no women's tackle football until like 99, 2000. And then we had a resurgence of the game, and it has stayed since then. Whether or not it's grown is really hard to say, because since that time, there have been all of these decentralized leagues that pop up and go under. And there's teams that pop up and go under. And like, there's teams operating all over the country in most major cities, in, you know, at least one of the leagues. They're really like prevalent. But then you actually dig and look at what the team actually is. And often there's no money. Often there's no fans. Often, like, there's not even very good coaching. It's probably not much better than like junior high football. And then you have other teams, like, you know, the Boston team is a good example of that, that really is like a machine, and they're incredible at what they do, and they're playing on really a professional level. And so what I can say is that it has remained consistent, and there are women who have been playing consistently for the last 20, 23, 24 years. But and there are certain leagues that have been successful in starting to get more mainstream recognition. One of the leagues, the Women's Football Alliance, their championship game has been televised on like ESPN3 the last few seasons. The rest of their games are streaming on Facebook Live, right? But their championship games have been broadcast on ESPN3 the last couple seasons. But again, it feels like it's like, I'll use the word like failure to launch, right? It feels like people get really close, but nothing. I mean, again, the Boston team is local to me. They are the best women's football team in the world. And I go to their games, and there's been a documentary made about them. You know, they're getting local press. Their quarterback, who is the winningest quarterback in women's football history, has her jersey in, you know, the Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. And there's still like a few hundred people at the game. Like, they're playing on this like high school field with some really uncomfortable bleachers, and like, you know, that's still the product that we have.
I had a question lined up, and as soon as you said bleachers, I just had this visceral flashback to hating sitting on those things, especially in the winter.
I have one of those like little folding, like, create make a seat, you know, situations that I bought specifically to attend the game those games because the bleachers are so uncomfortable.
I do not miss that at all. I remember covering games where I used to write for a high school paper and just praying that there nobody was there, because if they were, then you had to be on the bleachers, and if you were on the bleachers, like, you were going to pay for it. Let me close with this question for you, because it kind of gets at sports and government, and that's what our listeners are really into. And I'm always curious where people fall on this kind of question. So you made a point in the piece you wrote about Joe Biden and the government's once again disappointing behavior, which can apply, I feel, to a lot of what Joe Biden does. But you made a point in that piece that one reason that Title IX, I think you were saying, can be used, is used so often against, it's like weaponized against trans individuals, because it's rooted in the idea that gender is, like, I think you said, it's a body and not an experience or something like that. Like girlhood is cemented as something. Let me see if I can find the language for that. Here we go. Sorry, but 1 second. I want to give you the actual quote. And here we go. Here we go. You know, Title IX, because of the way it is written, allows for this kind of discrimination against transgender athletes and transgender girls and women in particular. That's because when Title IX was passed, the need for its existence relied on arguments that there were biological differences between girls and boys, which created a need for separate divisions. It made the definition of girlhood, in quotes, reliant on a body rather than on a concept of gender. Do you think then that's part of what we need, is a new Title IX that that addresses the reality of the, and is there any political on the federal level? Is there any, do you know of any federal momentum for anyone towards trying to write or get such a thing done?
Yeah. So I wrote a piece for last summer for the 50th anniversary of Title IX for Mother Jones, that if people are interested in this, they should check out. It's basically about how Title IX has, it's basically about how there will never be full trans inclusion as long as Title IX remains in the way that it exists today. And, you know, the Biden administration put out this new, it hasn't been passed yet, right? There's still challenges and stuff like that, but it was supposedly to ensure that transgender students were protected from discrimination under Title IX. And what it said in terms of athletics was it wouldn't allow for these kind of blanket bans on trans girls competing that we have seen being passed across the country, but it would basically allow for case-by-case discrimination. Right. And the reasons that were given were, again, that red herring of fairness. And then the idea of, like, safety, right? That, like, trans girls are somehow big and scary and a physical danger in a contact sport to cis girls. Again, no scientific evidence for this either.
Sure, so there's no evidence of that at all.
No evidence for this at all. But these are, like, these kind of very, very well-trod turf arguments have found their way into the government you know, language now. So to go back to your question, Title IX itself, to me, is actually where we see the idea of sex segregated sports being codified into law. Title IX is the reason that we think that sports should be segregated by binary sex, you know, on a mainstream level. And at the time that it was passed, there were feminist groups pushing for this not to happen this way, but, you know, saying that we're just creating another place, basically saying we're creating another separate but equal, right? That we just deemed unconstitutional a decade and a half ago, when it came, you know, to racial segregation. And so what happened when Title IX was passed, which, you know, originally did not pertain to athletics, it pertained to, like, scholarships and faculty positions and things like that, and became applied to athletics, it relied, getting it passed ended up relying on arguments that women, boys and girls were biologically different, and therefore there needed to be separate gender categories, for men and women. And if you dig into this further away from the gender-based, you will come back to capitalism and find that they did not want to take funding away from men's sports. They did not want to kind of threaten the money machine of men's sports. And there were real big pushbacks to this. It's very, very interesting if people want to go look at all of this. But from a you know, perspective that we have now, where trans girls are getting caught up in this, is that Title IX clarified and defined being a girl based on the biological bodily differences between boys and girls. As a result of that, it allows for discrimination against trans girls by, again, defining girlhood as, you know, somebody is as bodily and biologically based. Do I know of anyone doing the work, like, in the government to kind of move away from that? I don't, but if people are interested in this, there's a scholar by the name of Elizabeth Sharrow, Sharrow, who does, in my mind, some of the best work around Title IX and, you know, trans inclusion, and really thinking deeply and critically about how Title IX is being used to trans exclusionary ends, and like what a change in that regard would look like.
Do you have anything that you want to pitch that our readers should be aware of to keep an eye out for or an ear out for anytime soon?
Like of mine?
It could be anybody. I meant you, but if you have anything you want to pitch, you know, give a shout.
Well, I don't know. I am writing again for the first time in a long time. So I have a lot of different stuff in the works that I am pretty excited about. And actually, what I'm very excited about too is I have a couple big pieces that are not sports related that are going to be coming out relatively soon. I know. I was able to monetize my neurodivergent special interests into pieces.
That is how you beat the system. Good job. I respect that. it's always nice to remind people that there are like other parts of you than the sports bits. That's cool. That's very cool. Well, Frankie, this really was a pleasure and an honor. And I thank you for your time. And I thank you for all the information and all the wisdom that you shared. And hope to talk to you again sometime in the future.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Take care of yourself.
You too.
So that is probably about it for this episode, I think. I did the NBA. I gave you my Man City rap. Baseball, I really don't care about until Man City is done. So if you're fiending for a baseball episode, I'm sure you can find one somewhere out there, but not this show until probably middle of June. I'll give the Mets time to start winning, and then I'll be ready to start talking. But that is all for this episode of the Jacobin Sports Show. I imagine you probably do follow us on Twitter, if you have Twitter, and if you listen to this show. But I'll say it again, at Jacobin Sports. Email, jacobinsports@gmail.com. You can follow today's guest, Frankie de la Creta, at Frankie the DLC. That's Frankie K-I-E at the end. The DLC. Please subscribe to our Patreon. Encourage others to subscribe to our Patreon. Get it as a gift. It's $5. Get it for someone as a gift. Oh, go get it as a gift. I'll wait here until you're back.